Good morning. Well, this morning, last night, what we did is we spent the time talking about kind of a framework for understanding culture, which is asking that question, which this film series that Dick mentioned, For the Life of the World. Seriously, this is one of my new absolute favorites. So if you're looking for something to take you from belief to action, to take you from understanding to engagement, this is really a terrific thing. And it helps Christians of all, and especially if you have middle school, high school students, you wanted to do something together, although it's not a youth curriculum, small group studies. I just led it at my church, and I think the average age of my church is about 74. So, and we had a great time with it. And it's a great fit, too, with the book Restoring All Things. And so that's really what I talked about last night, is a lot more out of Restoring All Things. Now, what I want to do is apply it to one of the key issues of our day, which, of course, is same-sex marriage. This is the book that Sean and I wrote in 2014 on this topic. And has Sean been here, Dick? He has? Yeah. So Sean and I are friends. People ask us, why did you guys write a book on same-sex marriage? And we're like, easy. We were just looking for a way to make some more friends and thought that would be the best way to do it. Now, obviously, you don't write that book unless you really feel like you have to, right? I mean, we had conversations with our wives, and our wives were like, are you sure you want to do this? And so on. And we have probably lost some friends over it, certainly some Facebook fans over it. It's a difficult issue. And listen, if you don't, it's an issue that I think we have two equal and opposite reactions from. One is kind of the escapist thing, right? I don't believe that. I'm going to stay over here. We talked about these two. Escape is one thing that Christians like to do. I'm going to stay over here. I'm going to lob my Bible verse bombs over the wall, you know, into, you know, to where those people are. And we stay separate from it. I'm just going to tell you, if you're of my generation or younger, you realize that for many of us, myself included, this issue is not an issue over the wall. It's an issue around the Thanksgiving table and around Christmas. It's an issue in our homes. It's an issue in our families. It's an issue in our neighborhoods. And I remember where I realized this. It was at a summit conference in 2000 and, I would say, I don't know, maybe 2004 or 2005 in Tennessee. And I was working with a group of students there. We had somebody come through who had a testimony about coming out of that lifestyle, now married, has a couple kids, and was working at Focus on the Family. And a great story of Christ's redemption, pulling him out of that that world, that lifestyle. And for the next 2 weeks, for the rest of the conference, these students would come up with more questions, which was great. We loved that. But he would ask questions like, hey, I've got this friend who's a lesbian. I've got this friend who's gay. I've got this friend. I've got this friend. I've got this friend. And that's when it hit me. And it hit me that when I was their age, I would have never started the conversation with, I have this friend that was. Does that make sense? In other words, this wasn't something that was separate from their lives. It was something that was part of their lives. And one option, which I think a lot of Christians have taken, is, well, we shouldn't be friends. And I think that's absolutely unbiblical. Right? If you don't have unbelievers in your life, you're not living out the gospel. Right? How are you going to be a restorative presence in the world if we don't know anybody who's broken? By the way, you do know somebody who's broken. It's you, right? Yeah. So, but anyway, I think that's one. The other one, which is really, I think, also equally tempting, is the accommodation one, accommodating to the spirit of the age. There's not a single issue across culture right now where Christians are more tempted to think, well, the church got it wrong, the historical interpretation of the, of the church on issues of sex and marriage from the very beginning of time and so on. They got it wrong. Because, I don't know, to me, there's not another issue that I see in culture where I feel the tension between truth and love more than this one. Does that make sense? Between the first commandment, loving God, and loving neighbor, right? Do you feel that? Do you feel that? If you have people like this in your life, you know that you feel like if you speak the truth, you can't be loving. And if you are loving, you can't actually speak the truth. Does anybody know what I'm talking about here? All right, and so this is and certainly that's what we're accused of, or that's what is told to us, that you have to choose between one and the other. So here's where we have to begin. We always want to begin with a big picture theological framework from the 30,000 foot view, and that's this: Jesus Christ is truth. Jesus Christ is life. If there's a conflict between truth and life, it's in our mind, not in Him. Does that make sense? So we got to start there, and then we move forward. Now, when we look at specific cultural issues, I gave you last night four questions to ask, to actually look at culture and get involved. What I want to do now is give you three questions to ask to understand culture. Because if we don't actually take the time to really think through culture well, Christians tend to be reactionary, right? Something will come down the pike and we will panic, like Harry Potter, you know, that sort of stuff, right? And this happens like every so often. What we need to do is slow down, calm down, look at the culture in the confidence of the gospel. Let me just say that. I think a church that is looking for an idol of safety is a church that lacks the confidence of the gospel, right? And what Christians should be, I think, first and foremost. I mean, Peter talked about this. Peter said to a group of Christians who were facing cultural pressure under Nero, and what Peter said in 1 Peter, always be ready to give an answer for the hope that you have. The book of 1 Peter, which is written to a group of Christians so persecuted they're being dispersed. In fact, Peter actually uses Old Testament exile language. Like this is a reenactment of the exile where an outside force has come in and poof. I mean, that's how Peter is talking to this group of people. And the thing that this book is, if Philippians is the book of joy, Peter's the book of hope. And it's the book of hope in a particular context in which things are really going south, right? And so Peter, by the way, I would suggest read 1 Peter over and over and over again for this particular cultural moment. Now, all that to say, let me give you those three questions, okay? Because that's going to really frame out kind of what we're going to talk about. The first question is, what's really going on here, all right? And when you talk about what's really going on, you don't just look at this incident or that Supreme Court decision or this law change or this TV show. You want to back up and see the trends, not just the isolated incidents. Does that make sense? You want to look at the trends. Let me give it to you in another context. When Harry Potter came down, a lot of people were panicking because it seemed like witchcraft and that sort of stuff. But if you backed up and said, well, what's really going on here? What you realized was, wait a minute, it's not only Harry Potter, it's also The Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia. And Rick Warren just sold a billion copies of A Purpose-Driven Life. And Oprah started to become spiritual. What's going on really is that a culture exhausted by secularism was looking for something spiritual. Do you see the difference there? Now, I'm not saying there wasn't anything questionable in Harry Potter or that Oprah is okay, right? I mean, gosh, if I thought she was okay, I'd lose all of my jokes, right? So, that's not, right? My point is that you have to back up and look at the trends. The second question is, why is it going on really? Why is it going on really? For example, sometimes we're just so quick to just say, why is the gay movement happening? Well, because they want to destroy America, right? Well, maybe some do, but I'll tell you, right, most of those who identify as gay and lesbian have no knowledge of a conspiracy if it's happening. Is there a gay agenda? I'll throw it out there. Yeah, there are people with a gay agenda. They had an agenda. There's actually a book and so on. Is every person who identifies as gay and lesbian or a sympathizer part of the gay agenda? No, right? Just like, I mean, I wish every Christian was part of God's agenda, but we're not, right? I mean, it's just, we're not all always like swiping the card. It doesn't mean the issues aren't important, but we got to back up and say, why is it going on? Why is it happening? And then the third question will reflect my talk, the last talk last night, which is about the image of God. If the image of God is so central in the story of Scripture, which is the story of the world, if it's so central, one of the great questions we can ask to understand what's happening in our culture is what's happening to people? Or you could ask it this way, what's it like to live here? How many of you guys saw the movie Amazing Grace with Wilberforce? Does that ring a bell? Okay, so do you remember that when the Clapham group came and were trying to recruit Wilberforce in, right, at that dinner? And you remember they started to talk about slavery and they started to describe it in very real terms. And then the one guy got up and showed his brand and then also put the shackles around his neck and the shackles around his ankles and talked how many died. You remember what they were doing is they were forcing Wilberforce to realize that ideas have victims, they're not just esoteric. And when we start asking what happens to real people in the real world in light of this, that's where some of these questions come from. So that's going to frame out, all right? That's how we're going to look at this. So, by the way, in the book, the first half of this book is how should we think about it? The second half of the book is what do we do now? And that's really going to be the framework of this morning. The first part is how do we think about it? The second talk, I'm going to expand it to sexual brokenness in general, and we're going to talk about what do we do. Okay, so that's where we're going. Let's start with kind of what's happened. If we ask that question, what's happened? when it comes to same-sex marriage. Here it is. Ready? We have just been in the middle of one of the great social revolutions that the world has seen. Now, that sounds a little hyperbolic, right? But I mean by that, and I don't mean great as in morally great, I mean great as in successful great. In other words, we have just seen an enormous social revolution that we haven't really seen on hardly any other issue that we can remember, except for things like civil rights, for a long time. And I'm not equating the two. I'm just saying the speed at which same-sex marriage went from being unthinkable to being unquestionable is remarkable. Right? I mean, you remember this? And there's a number of ways to look at this. You can look at this politically, right? In 2004, wrong presidency. What year is it? When was Obama president? Oh, yeah, 2008, sorry. In 2008, right, which was President Obama's first inauguration, the man who was asked to pray during that inauguration was Pastor Rick Warren, right? That year, in 2008, was when the Proposition 8 battle was happening in California, right? Which, on a state level, they were deciding whether to define marriage as between a man and a woman. And so it was known, Prop 8 was known as an anti-gay marriage bill, right? I mean, and Rick Warren went on record supporting Prop 8. He went on record saying that marriage is between a man and a woman, that same-sex marriage is not the same as marriage. He made a video of himself and emailed it to his very small church of, 100,000 people, and that got shared and shared and shared and shared. Yet that year, he was still allowed to pray at President Obama's first inauguration, even though that year he had campaigned against same-sex marriage. Fast forward 4 years, just 4 years, President Obama's second inauguration. The man that was asked to pray was a guy named Louis Giglio. Louis Giglio is known for his work specifically in dealing with sex trafficking. Louis Giglio doesn't make same-sex marriage an issue ever, on anything that he says or writes or talks about, and yet he was disinvited from praying at President Obama's second inauguration because some gay activists unearthed a sermon that he had preached, ready, 20 years earlier, in which he never mentioned gay marriage at all, but in which in the list of sexual sins that Christ could save you from, he listed gay. And 4 years later, because of a sermon he had preached 20 years earlier, it was intolerable for him to pray. You see how fast that happened? That is an amazing amount of speed, right? When Sean and I started to write this book in 2013, there were 11 states that recognized same-sex marriage. By the time the book came out in the middle of 2014, that had jumped to 30, right? I mean, that's how fast. And do you feel like you kind of like, where did this come from? It kind of came out of nowhere and it was really fast and so on. And so the speed at which this went from being unthinkable to unquestionable is unbelievable. Now, but the other question is, how did it happen, right? How did it happen, or why did it happen? And the answer to that question is, it didn't happen because we had a national-level reasonable argument. And what I mean, it wasn't because one side got up and gave their arguments and another side got up and gave their arguments, right? And it's, by the way, we didn't get it because politics shifted. We got it because, not through politics and not through argument, we got it through the cultural imagination. Right? The cultural imagination, if Christians could learn to understand and shape the cultural imagination, that's where the power is. In other words, we didn't get it because politicians reasonably argued back and forth about it. We got same-sex marriage because it actually, for the larger population in America, and especially the elites, became unthinkable to resist. Does that make any sense? In other words, it just became inevitable. It just became the way people thought. And that's what I want to talk about, is how did that get there and where did this go? Because I want you to understand right off the bat, ready? Same-sex marriage is not the root of anything. It's the fruit. All right? It's not the cause. It's the effect. Same-sex marriage is at the end of a whole set of ideas that came through our culture. Let me give you an illustration about this. I grew up in the golden age of television, the 1980s, and the number one show that decade, number one show, it was almost every year in the 80s, the same show was number one, and what was it? The Cosby Show. Right? We watched that show, we watched those kids grow up, right? I mean, it was very, very interesting. But one of the most interesting things about that show is that it was centered around the family, but not only centered around the family, it pictured family, ready, as the solution to problems. That's where you went to get your problem solved. Most episodes of The Cosby Show were pretty similar. There's a problem, a crisis. You know, Theo had cheated on a test, or Rudy was hiding in a cupboard pouting somewhere. And then there was, you know, then there was conversation and dialogue. And 30 minutes later, there was what? Resolution. Just like in your house, all the problems get fixed in 30 minutes. Right? County commercials, right, yeah. And so that was The Cosby Show. Fast forward one decade to the 90s. Right? And there were two very popular shows of that decade. One was, the most popular show was Friends, right? And where was family in that show? It was there, but when it was there, it was never the solution. It was usually the problem. So in one decade, we went from the family being the solution to family being the problem. Seinfeld was the same way, right? When, remember George's dad? Okay, so you have this center. Okay, so So you have that, you know, you fast forward one decade and that's the change. Now, the very next show that became popular in the middle of the 90s, and what's so interesting is all of these shows were on Thursday's NBC's must-see lineup, right? This was the most popular night on television back then. Middle of the 90s was another show called Will and Grace. I've only agreed with Vice President Joe Biden, I think, once in my entire life, and that was when he said that Will and Grace did more to teach us than anything anyone's done so far. And what was the topic? Same-sex marriage. That we learned more from Will and Grace. What did we learn from Will and Grace? Well, Will and Grace was a show with had two gay characters that were first and foremost in the show. One was a little bit more flamboyant. The other, Will, was kind of the main character, right? And he wasn't the first gay character on television. That goes to Billy Crystal in the show Soap back in the 60s. Right? What was the thing about Will and Grace? What was the thing about Will in Will and Grace? Will was the normal one. Will was the straight one. He was the straight one in the sense he was the straight guy. Like, another, put it this way. Will played the role in Will and Grace that Cliff Huxtable played in The Cosby Show. Right? Will was where heterosexual Grace went to get her problem solved. Does that make any sense? So that's the transition. Now fast forward to today. What do we got? Modern Family. The new Cosby Show is Modern Family. And what is the modern family? Well, you got three options. Take your pick. There's a traditional family, there's a divorce, remarried, trophy wife, and there's a same-sex couple. All of them count as the modern family. Do you see what happened? This became kind of this kind of cultural evolution. We did not get same-sex marriage through argument. We got it through the imagination, right? And so you could see, and that's the 80s, right? I mean, the shift, the speed, and so on. How do things happen? It's because, and let me say this over and over and over and over again, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, politics is downstream from culture. Politics is downstream from culture. What happens in culture gives us the politics, right? It's not always the case. Sometimes politics is upstream, but most of the time, it's downstream, right? Now, so what's happened? Great social revolution. Why did it happen? Why did it happen? It happened through the cultural imagination. And that third question is, what's it like to live here? And that gets to the point of this. I want to wrestle now with, what was the nature of the revolution? What was the nature of this social revolution that brought us this remarkable change at in such a short period of time? We are tempted, I think particularly as Christian conservatives, we are tempted to see everything in exclusively moral terms. Do you know what I mean by that? In other words, what we mean is, well, this used to be wrong, and now people think it's okay. This used to be taboo, and now people think it's acceptable. This used to be abnormal or antisocial, and now people think it's normal, right? And you know what? Obviously, we've seen a moral slide in a culture. Is that fair enough? I mean, there were things that you didn't do that now you do, and there's things that you did that now you don't do anymore. There has been a moral slide. But if we understand this issue as a moral slide in our culture only, we're under-understanding it. In other words, that's not the whole story, right? I want to give you an article, and I want you to go read this article. I think this is the most important article that I read in the year 2013, okay? It's an article by a blogger named Rod, R-O-D, Dreher, D-R-E-H-E-R. Rod Dreher, D-R-E-H-E-R. And here's the title of the article. Make sure you Google this exactly, put it in quotes when you do, okay? Sex After Christianity. Sex After Christianity, Rod Dreher. Here's what Rod Dreher argued, and he's exactly right, that the nature of this social revolution, where this thing went from being unthinkable to unquestionable in such a short amount of time, was not just a moral slide. Here's what he called it. Ready? He said, what we have just seen is a cosmological shift. In other words, it's not just a shift of our understanding of right and wrong. It's actually a shift in our understanding of all of reality. We think we now inhabit a different world than previous generations thought. It's been a shift. The word we use around the Colson Center, it's been a shift in worldview, right? In other words, we've gone from seeing the human person as being someone made in the image of God, or someone that is valuable based on what they contribute to the world, to now seeing the human person in almost exclusively sexual terms. And I'm going to talk about where that came from, but I want to describe it with a story first. There was a major news event that happened a couple years ago in the sports world where a guy named Jason Collins announced that he was gay. And why this made such national news, and actually international news, is that he was the first male athlete in a major U.S. team sport, one of the biggies, the NBA, to announce that he was gay. And he was still active in that sport, right? So there was lots of questions. He did it, by the way, in the pages of Sports Illustrated. He wrote, I'm in the NBA, I'm black, and I'm gay. I think that was the title of the article. And he went through and he just said, this is who I am, and so on. And he announced it to the world. And lots of interesting things about the article. One of the most interesting things is in the middle of it, he said, not only am I gay, but I'm a Christian. And I know Jesus is okay with that because Jesus is a God of love and tolerance, you know, a person of love and tolerance and so on. And so he was able to put the two together. Now, there's no doubt, because I've been in this, I know there's no evidence of it now, but I used to play basketball, and I did, really. There's a culture, you know, a hoops culture, where that's not the most popular thing you can say. So when, you know, you say, did it take courage for him to say that? I think it did. If he was expecting backlash, he really didn't get it, did he? The support and the acclaim was almost universal. Major NBA, you know, legends tweeted their support. Michelle Obama tweeted her support. President Obama picked up the phone and called him and to congratulate him. I mean, this was a big deal. And there was a line, and you've heard this line. Whenever someone comes out like this in the public square, there's a line now that we use about this. Something like this. Finally, this person can just, what? Be themselves. They no longer have to hide what? Who they are. You know the line, right? In other words, there's this idea that now they can just be them. Now, later on that day, it was the talk of all the major sports television shows and so on. I was watching Outside the Lines on ESPN, which is a great show, and one of my favorite NBA analysts was on that show on that day talking about this particular announcement, a guy named Chris Broussard. And they were asking him very legitimate questions at first, questions like, is this going to affect the locker room? Will this mean he won't get picked up by other teams? Will other people now feel more welcome to come out? And so on. These are legitimate questions, sports-related at least, in terms of the sport. And then they asked him this question, because Chris is known to be a Christian. Hey, Chris, in the article, Jason Collins said that he's Christian and he's gay, and that's completely okay. You're a Christian too, aren't you? What do you think about that? And all God's people said, awkward. I mean, how do you answer? How do you answer this question on national television? Well, Chris answered it, and he goes, you know what? I think that as a Christian, I believe in what the Bible says about sex and that God created sex between a man and a woman, and any sort of sex outside of that, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual or whatever, is a sin. How do you think that went over? Oh, man, they called for his firing. They called for his resignation. A whole lot of people called for his head on a stick, you know? I mean, it was huge. Now, and what he was told, even though he was asked the question, is you can't bring that opinion here. You have to keep that view, what, to yourself. Now, you say, John, what are you getting at? Here's what I'm getting at. Hold with me. In a nutshell, here's the way Western civilization understands humanity. You don't believe that, do you? In a nutshell. See, Western Civ has some distinctives. And even though there's differences within Western civilization, one of the commonalities was from the Greek influence, the Roman influence, the Jewish influence, and the Christian influence, and even the Enlightenment influence, the understanding, the primary understanding of what it means to be human is that we are metaphysical creatures. Now, I don't mean that we are all God worshipers. What it means is that we're the sort of creatures that asks metaphysical questions. And what we mean by that is just the big questions of life, like is there a God and is there truth and how do we know and what's wrong with the world and what makes us different than the animals and what's the meaning and purpose of life, right? These are questions that humans ask. And so and different schools of thought answer those questions in different ways, but the commonality was what we all believed is that what it means to be human is to ask these questions and our behavior is on the side. So who we are is our metaphysical questioning, right? And what we do has to be contextualized within those answers. Now, we might answer these questions as atheists or as Epicureans or Stoics or something like that, and our behavior, including our sexual behavior, will be as loose as our answers allow, but you understand what it means to be a human is to ask these big questions about God and truth and morality, and behavior is on the side. Jason Collins makes an announcement about his sexual behavior, and he's told that's who you are. Chris Broussard makes some metaphysical observations, and he's told you have to keep that to yourself. Do you see the great swap? That's what's taking place. That's what Rod Dreher is arguing, is that what we've seen is not just we're a culture that used to think homosexual activity was bad, and now we think it's okay. It's that we now live in a culture in which what we once thought was a human being, we no longer think is a human being, and what's replaced that, the most distinct understanding of what gives us human value, what gives us human dignity, what it means to be human, is sexual autonomy. We are tethering human dignity in our culture to sexual autonomy, and we're doing it all over the place. Now, the question then becomes, where did this come from? Where did this new vision of the human person come from? It came from a set of ideas that were put into our culture a long time ago. And I want to tell you these ideas because they're very important as we really start jumping into understanding specifically the question about marriage. This is the natural consequence. We say this all the time. Ideas have what? Consequences. Same-sex marriage is the inevitable consequence of the ideas of the sexual revolution. This is not a one-offer. This is part of the whole stream of thought that gave us pornography, that gave us sex education at the age of four in public schools, that gave us all kinds of different things, right? The sexual revolution gave us same-sex marriage. And there were a couple big ideas of the sexual revolution. I'm going to give them to you, right? These two big ideas have now become firmly embedded, right, in our way of thinking and living as people today. The first one is what I've already said, is that the fundamental part of our identity is our sexuality. Sexuality is the most important thing about us. Sexuality is the defining thing about us, right? What it means to be human is to have sexual inclinations and sexual urges. In other words, we're animals with a sexual urge. Does that make any sense? Okay, so that's the one thing. It's a question of identity. Here are the two other practical things that really give us same-sex marriage. Number one, that sex, marriage, and babies are separable. Sex, marriage, and babies aren't a package deal in the sexual revolution. That you can have sex without marriage. You can have sex without babies. Right? And when you think about this, you can kind of go through the whole gamut. First of all, we wanted sex without marriage. Then we wanted sex without babies. Right? One of the great things that drove the sexual revolution forward was the pill. Right? Now, the pill has good uses and bad uses, but what it ended up being was not just a way to help families kind of manage women's health and so on. It really became I am completely autonomous over sexuality, and I have a right to have sex without having any children ever in my life. Right? So it really became, and you can see this, by the way, and I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but you can see this in the language we use about babies. We used to call the act of producing children procreation. Isn't that a beautiful word? We're pro what? Creation. What do we call it now? Reproduction. Recreation. Yeah, that's true. His wife's just like, oh my gosh. I'm not letting you out of the house again. That was awesome. I'm going to tweet that later, buddy. Okay. Now, the word we now use is reproduction. Now, at first glance, we're like, well, that's the same thing, is it? Does reproduction communicate the same thing as procreation? Procreation is something, it's like we're participating in a divine activity. Reproduction is like we're making cars. And you know what? When you are when you're producing, the end of the producing process is a product, not a creation. You see what I mean? And this is the way language shapes culture, right? So we want marriage and sex and babies not as a package deal. In fact, it's interesting. My friend Sean McDowell, he brought this up to me. And I was like, yeah, you're exactly right. We knew we wanted to have sex without babies. Do you realize now we're so much separating these three things that now we have babies without sex? You see what I mean? I mean, we've just kind of changed the whole model. And that has never, and that thing, that those three things go together, by the way, sex, marriage, and babies, has been part of the human experience from the very beginning. This is why, and we'll get into this a little bit more, but this is why cultures from the beginning of time had something called marriage. And without ever going to Scripture, you can see marriage in virtually every society, with very, very few exceptions who had other ways to govern sexual activity. But even societies, by the way, who tolerated and embraced and loved homoerotic experiences and homosexual activity still didn't call it marriage, because sex, marriage, and babies came together in a package deal. That kind of sex, marriage, and babies came together, right? Maggie Gallagher, who we quote an awful lot, she's a brilliant thinker, Catholic thinker on marriage, been writing on this a long time. She said, look, you have to have marriage because of three things. These three things are always true in the human experience without any question, and that's these three things. Ready? Number one, sex makes babies. Can we move on? Okay, number two, society needs babies. Right? Why? If society doesn't have babies, what happens? They die, right? We're seeing this literally in Europe as we speaketh, right? We're seeing this in China when you don't have, when you keep all the boys and kill all the girls, right? Like we talked in the early church house. This is happening in China right now, right? So society needs babies. And the third thing is babies need a mom and a dad. Now, listen, that part is being redebated. But that was debated all the way back in Plato and Aristotle's time. There was a disagreement on whether the society should raise children or parents should raise children, right? Whether the government, whether that a child is really belongs to the state or belongs to a family first and foremost. And the Greeks actually ended up settling, not from any sort of Christian view, but because of natural revelation, they settled on the fact, no, you know, kids do better in families. Families do a better job producing children than the state. Good heavens, I just go through TSA and I can tell you that, right? So those three things, throughout the history of the world, these three things have been considered together, sex, marriage, and babies, because of those three reasons. But now, the sexual revolution said these three things can be separate. Margaret Sanger did not promote abortion, first and foremost. Did you know that? Now, she founded Planned Parenthood, and Planned Parenthood does, because they make a lot of money off of it. Well, what Margaret Sanger primarily promoted was birth control. She primarily promoted the separation of sex, marriage, and babies. That was her number one thing to communicate. And she talked, by the way, about sex as if the orgasm was a replacement for salvation. Does that make sense? So this is that. Now, I said three big ideas of the sexual... Are you keeping track of my list? Am I losing you on my list? Sorry, it's all clear in my head. Okay, so we said the first thing is that the most important thing about us as human beings is our sexuality. The second thing is sex, marriage, and babies are separable. Here's the third thing, and this is huge. Men and women are interchangeable. Men and women are interchangeable. Now, that started with men and women are interchangeable in roles. And then it became men and women are interchangeable in essence. That there's really no differences. All right. Now, when you put those three things together, those ideas, then eventually they start playing themselves out, which is divorce goes from being unthinkable to an unquestionable right, right? And marriage becomes something that's really not so much about kids and babies, but it's about my own autonomy, right? And that brings us then to specifically to the question of same-sex marriage. Let me just see where I'm at time-wise. Okay. That brings us specifically to the question of same-sex marriage. And as we jump specifically on same-sex marriage, in light of where this stuff came from, I want to stop and deal with something that's very important. Whenever you wrestle with what to do on same-sex marriage. When somebody brings it up, aren't you for same-sex marriage or something? I'm going to give you a question. Aren't you for, because typically it comes in this form, right? Aren't you for marriage, what? What's the word we hear? Marriage equality. Marriage equality. And what are you going to say? No. Right? We had the same problem with the abortion issue. People are like, are you pro-choice? Do you believe in a woman's right to choose? And we're like, no. Wait a minute. I do believe in a woman's right to choose almost everything. The question is, well, which choices do people have a right to and which choices? In other words, what do you mean by choice? Can I give you a question? Please keep this question in your back pocket. Use it at everything. It's a great way thing to use with your kids to have great conversation. Use this question. What do you mean by that? 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 In other words, use the question about defining terms. You need to be able to define terms. When somebody says, I believe in a woman's right to choose, don't say, I don't. Of course you believe in a woman's right to choose where she goes, whether she works, you know, what she wears, who she marries, where she lives. But you don't believe in a woman, anybody's right to choose the taking of innocent life. Do you see the difference? And so sometimes we lose the language game before we start. Somebody says, I believe in marriage equality. You're going to say, I don't. What you need to ask is, what do you mean by marriage? What do you mean by marriage? Before we say something's equal, we have to decide what that thing is. The most important question on same-sex marriage is, what is marriage? I'll take you all the way back to T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot was a brilliant thinker, and T.S. Eliot said, whenever you see something new, two questions come to mind. What can it do, or what can you do with it? And the other question is, what is it for? Right? So if I've never seen a laptop before, and I walk up and there's a laptop sitting on the counter, which question should I begin with? What can I do with this laptop, or what is this laptop for? What's the most important question? What's it for? Because I can come up with all kinds of things to do with a laptop. Right? I mean, it opens and closes. I could have a puppet show. Right? Right? I could skip it across the lake, right? If it's smooth and flat like a MacBook Air, right? Right? If it was a Dell, I would just do it, right? But you get the point. The point is, before I decide what I should do with something, I need to decide what is that something for. What we've just been told is that the Supreme Court in Obergefell, which then took and imposed imposed same-sex marriage on all the states, what we were told was that we've now expanded the definition of marriage. We've done something to marriage to open it up, to make it more inclusive and more expansive. Well, they did that without ever asking the question, what is marriage for? And that's really where the rub is. Because there's really two different answers to that question, what is marriage for? There's the historic answer, the old answer, the answer that's been true for the entire history of civilization until yesterday. And then there's the new answer. The old answer is that what marriage is for is primarily for the future of civilization. Marriage is the best institution there is for producing, protecting, and promoting future generations. And this has been embedded in our understanding, right? That's what people care about. That's what the government cares about. I know this because when I went to get a marriage license, I was in Dayton, Tennessee. I was living down in East Tennessee, down in the Deep South. And I went to the county clerk at the Ray County Courthouse, and I said, I would like a marriage license to marry Sarah. And she asked me questions before she gave me a license. And it's indicative which questions she asked, because here's what she did not ask. She did not ask me, no, wait a minute, are you guys really in love? I mean, seriously, are you going to be in love forever? Here's Cosmo magazine. There's a test inside. Take the test from Cosmo, and if you pass it, I'll give you a marriage license. No, that's not the question she asked. She asked these questions. She asked, are you old enough, and is she old enough? Right? Because if we're not over 18, we belong to another family already. There's already a family unit, right, that's producing us forward, and we don't have autonomy on this issue. The second question was, are either of you already married? Right? Which I didn't know was an important question to ask in Tennessee. I'm just thinking, you know, Utah, that makes sense. Tennessee, not so sure. Okay. The third question she asked was, are you related? Which is a good question to ask in Tennessee. Okay, I'm just going to say it. It is. It really is. It really is. It happens. Now, you say, John, what's your point? My point is, all of those questions reflected the government's concern. The government's concern wasn't in the sincerity of our love. It wasn't in the sincerity of our affection. It was in the potential the potential of this union to produce children. Right? And that's what marriage has always been. Because sex makes babies, society needs babies, and babies need a mom and a dad. Right? Now, the new definition, what Ryan Anderson calls, and Robbie George call in their book, What is Marriage? What we talk about in our book, we quote them in our book, Same-Sex Marriage. We try to bring their thinking down to an understandable level. The new definition is what we'll call the revisionist view. And I'm not trying to be mean to that view. I'm just saying it is a revisionist view. And that's this, that the primary purpose of marriage is to further our happiness. The primary purpose of marriage is to further our happiness. Right? If the primary purpose of marriage is to further our happiness, then marriage is not connected in any inherent way with babies. Marriage has always been connected that way. Remember what I said earlier. Even societies that did not have any moral stance against homosexual behavior, even societies that tolerated and promoted homosexual behavior never called it marriage. Right? Because it was always understood that the primary purpose of marriage had to do with the potential of children. Right? But what we've done now is saying that marriage has nothing to do with children. Right? Marriage is about happiness. And if marriage is about happiness, you get married when you want, you leave marriage when you want, you marry whoever you want, and so on. Does that make sense? So that's really what's happening here. Before we decide marriage equality, we need to decide what is marriage. Is marriage for this or is marriage for that? Now, you say, well, wait a minute, what difference does it make? Just call something else marriage. You've got this union and you can just call this marriage. And what difference does it make? You're still going to have kids. Well, listen, if you call everything the same thing, you lose the word that you need to actually help this. There's a reason that the government actually rewards marriage, because marriage does things the government can't. And if marriage doesn't do it, the government has to step in. We know whenever a child is raised outside of the context of a mom and a dad in the home, typically, not always, but typically, the government has to step in, right? So we have entire communities. My friend Chris Brooks is a pastor in Detroit, Michigan. He now is dealing with a community in which for three straight generations, 70% of children are born outside of marriage with not a mom or a dad in the home, right? That means the government has to, what? Step in. Right? Some other institution has to carry the weight. So marriage itself is this institution that's there because of the future of civilization. And when we redefine marriage, we don't have a word for that. Maggie Gallagher uses this. It's a great little line. She said, look, we can call every four-legged furry creature a rabbit, and that makes things a lot more convenient. But now you don't have a word for things you really need a word for, right? So if you're hiking up the trail and these guys are running back this way and going, a rabbit, a rabbit, a rabbit, right? I mean, it's important to know which furry little four-legged creature is coming at you. Because if it's a rabbit, maybe they just have a weird rabbit phobia. If it's a skunk, you should run too. If it's a bear, you should call home and say your last goodbyes. You know, I mean, there's things you should do depending on what the essence of that thing is. Does that make sense? And what we've done now is we've redefined marriage. But let me just say this. Same-sex marriage is not the first legal maneuver that redefined marriage. Here's what I mean by that. Remember the two definitions. This one is about the children. This one is about happiness. We already did that. In fact, it was a conservative hero in the state of California in the 70s, that gave us a definition of marriage that said marriage was primarily about happiness, not about the children. It was Ronald Reagan, when he was the governor of California, the first one to put into law no-fault divorce, which quickly spread. I love Reagan, bad decision. Why? Because no-fault divorce said in law that marriage is not about the children, marriage is about my personal happiness. I enter marriage when I'm happy, I leave marriage when I'm unhappy. Here's what's so instructive about this. So instructive about this. Whenever we change the definition of marriage to being about us instead of being about the future, instead of being about like future generations and the children, it's about my personal happiness, who suffers? The future generation. Remember, there was a line. I don't remember this because I was born in 75. Some of you remember when the arguments for no-fault divorce, and I remember still hearing them when I was growing up. Here was the argument, right? Kids don't need married parents. Kids need happy parents. Do you guys remember this? Am I wrong on this? Didn't people say this? Like, well, kids will do better if their parents are happy, even if they're not married. And you know what? We said that because we thought it was true. They said it over and over and over. There was no data at the time to back up that claim. Guess what? We now have the data. And outside of cases of abuse, physical, sexual, emotional danger, it's not true. Kids did better with parents who stayed married, even if they weren't quote-unquote happy, than they did with divorce. Divorce has been the greatest social disaster in our nation's history. No-fault divorce. There's nothing else that has created the carnage than divorce on demand. You want to fix Detroit, Michigan? Fix marriage. You can go to a website called familyfacts.org. Now look, this steps on our toes. And I'm assuming in a room like this, there's people who have gone through divorce, maybe not by your choice, maybe past mistake, maybe, you know, all kinds of things and so on. And I'm not saying this is beyond redemption. I'm not saying your divorce has ruined America. What I am saying is that when a nation gets to a point where divorce is normal and one among many options, it's in big trouble. Kids really pay the price. And it's not lost, by the way, on the larger culture, that we didn't have any campaigns to stop divorce or marches on Washington to stop divorce, but we have a lot to stop same-sex marriage. People say, why are you being inconsistent? It's a good question. If you stack up the carnage, the bodies, you know, between what no-fault divorce has created in our culture and what same-sex marriage has created, or even homosexual activity in the lifestyle, which one has a whole lot more victims right now? It really does. But here's where the application comes from today. So just like we said something in the 70s as if it were true without having any knowledge that kids would do better with happy parents even if they weren't married, we have something that we're saying today. We're saying it over and over and over again as if it's true. And that's this. Kids don't need a mom and a dad. Kids just need loving parents. Remember the lies of the sexual revolution? Sex, marriage, and babies were separable. Men and women are what? Interchangeable. So kids don't need a mom and a dad. Kids just need two loving parents. The struggle that we're in right now is that it hasn't been long enough down the line on same-sex marriage to know the statistics, to know what same-sex marriage does in the life of children. We have some vignettes both ways. We have stories of kids who say, I love my gay parents, and they were great. We have stories of people who, like my friend Katie Faust, who says, I love my two lesbian mothers, but I needed a dad. So we got stories both ways. We got studies both ways. We've got one group of studies that say children of gay unions do just as well, maybe even better than heterosexual ones. The problems with those studies methodologically are deep. Like, for example, people opt into those studies. They know what they're being surveyed on before they opt in. They know what the results people are looking for. It's a loaded study. It's just completely bogus. And the sample group is remarkably small. And then you have Mark Regnerus' study, who's at the University of Texas. It's a much bigger study. It was a much more random representative sample of it. But he came up with conclusions that not only did children of same-sex unions not do as well, they did remarkably worse. And he got quickly crucified, and they pointed out some things in his study, which, by the way, he admitted were limitations of his study, but it's hard to use that one too. So we're in between. So what we're doing is we're saying this as if it's true. Kids just need loving parents. Kids just need loving parents. I will tell you what is not up in the air statistically, what's not up in the air in terms of social science data. Ready? Two things that we know about marriage and children. Ready? Number one, the most significant indicator by far of a child's long-term success is that he grew up and married in a home with married mom and a dad. Like, there's not a close second on this one. When you look at the indicators of a child's long-term success, by and far, the most significant indicator of a child's long-term success is that they grew up with mom and dad in the household. In fact, President Obama has recognized this. I think one of the best things President Obama, I don't agree with most of President Obama's decisions, but the thing that he's done the best in his presidency is actually do this push for black fathers to be involved in their families. He's got a whole initiative and so on. And I think it's actually been a really powerful sort of thing. And he says this, kids need a mom and a dad, kids need a mom and a dad, kids need a mom and a dad. He's partially right. What the studies don't tell us is that kids need a mom and a dad. What the studies tell us is that kids need a married mom and a dad, right? And this is why societies have long recognized this, right? Whenever a baby is born, there's a mom nearby. What marriage guarantees a society is that when a child is born, there's also going to be a dad nearby. Right? So that's the first thing we know, is that kids do better with a married mom and a dad in the household, statistically. The second thing we know is that men and women bring unique, distinct things to the lives of their children. Now, anybody here who's in a marriage and has children would say, no duh. But there's actually real questions about this. A few years ago, I had on my radio program a secular humanist evolutionist science writer. He does kind of popular level science writing. He takes all that heady stuff that we would never understand and he brings it just above our heads, so maybe we'll understand it. And his name was Paul Raeburn. And he was a great guy. I really enjoyed interviewing him. And I interviewed him because he had just written a book called Do Dads Matter? And I said, why did you write this book, Paul? And he said, well, I write on science stuff and I've started to notice that in the social science data, you know, there was all these studies about the importance of fathers to the lives of their children. He said, and this was a shift, because prior to 30 years ago, people just assumed that the only thing that dads brought to their children's lives was genetic material and money, right, financial support. And so other than that, dads didn't really matter. And so they really just studied, do moms matter? And I'm like, seriously, they spent money studying do moms matter? Because seriously, I mean, come on. Like, the scientific conclusion of that is, duh. Right? I mean, come on. Right? But he said 30 years ago, they started to study do dads matter? And I said, well, I get that, but I want to know why you wrote the book. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you spent all your time, all your books have been written on these kind of hard sciences, the physical sciences, right? Astronomy, he's done a lot on astronomy and physics and things like that. This is social science. Why did you write this book? And he said, honestly, it's because I have five kids and I wanted to know if I mattered. And I said, well, do you? And you know what the research says? On every level. Physically, emotionally, relationally, long-term, short-term, sexually, spiritually, even though he didn't believe in spirituality, all of these indicators are moms and dads. So here's what we know right now about marriage. Kids do better with married mom in the household, and men and women bring unique, distinct things to the lives of their children. In fact, just a month ago, we did a radio program on a study that came out of Kent State University where a researcher discovered that how dads play with their kids bring specific things to their children, right? You know how moms play with the kids, right? Which is very structured. Here's your crayon. Here's your napkin. You know how dads play with the kids? Woo! You know, so that's, basically they were saying, you know, they do different things. And so they were studying what difference does that make in the long term. And I don't know how you kind of get to cause and correlation and so on, but what they found is that especially on relational security and romantic involvement, how dads play with their kids makes a difference in the lives of their children. And I was like, sweet, and I went through my kids. So it was a good one. So you see what we know, right? We know those couple things. So what we're doing now is we've made a public policy decision which said that basically just put into law what the culture had already been communicating for a long time, which is that sex, marriage, and babies aren't a package deal, and that men and women are interchangeable. Now, I just want to end with this, because what we've done then is not, what our Supreme Court did not do is expand the definition of marriage to include more couples. What the Supreme Court did is fundamentally go from one definition of marriage to a different definition of marriage. Does that make sense? Right? And they did so in the name of discrimination. I'm going to make two more points, and then we'll take a break. Here's the first point. Our current definition of marriage right now, which is marriage is about the furthering of happiness, it will then be forced to include more and more people. Why? Here's the first thing. Ready? Our current definition of marriage is more discriminatory than our previous definition of marriage. Let me say that again, because you're like, what? Our current definition of marriage is more discriminatory than our previous one. Here's what I mean. If I go to McDonald's and I order a senior citizen coffee and they refuse to give it to me, they're discriminating against me. But is it arbitrary discrimination? No, because get this, follow me. It's not discrimination based on who I am. It's discrimination based on the definition of a senior citizen coffee. Now, if I go to McDonald's and I order a coffee, but they refuse to serve me because I'm balding, stop laughing. Then they're not discriminating based on the coffee. They're discriminating based on what? Me. Our previous definition of marriage, and I want you to understand this, we did not have a ban on same-sex marriage. That's how it's been communicated. No, we had a legal definition of marriage that left all kinds of people out. It wasn't based on the people. It was based on what definition of marriage is. In other words, it was a recognition that marriage has to do with children, and unions that do not bring children or unions that do bring children that could have, you know, problems, like, for example, incestuous couples. You follow me? Right? Or polygamous culture, polygamous ones or polyamorous ones that actually put children at risk. It was based on a definition of what marriage is. Does that make sense? What we've now done is pick up a definition that says marriage is about happiness and nothing more, and we're leaving people out. Now we're leaving them out based on who they are, not based on the definition of marriage. Because based on this new definition of marriage, it has nothing to do with children. Does that make sense? Okay, so we're being more discriminatory now, which means same-sex marriage is not the last stop on the train. It can't be. It cannot be, right? The next one will be polyamory. We already have the reality television show. We all know that's the first step. You get a reality TV show and then you're on, right? Polyamory is the first one. Polygamy would be a little bit tougher other than for some reasons. And the reason is because it's seen as abusive to women. So I think there's another outside reason that might limit that. But polyamory is the next one to go, which is if marriage doesn't have to do with children, right? Why does it have to do with two? You see what I mean? There's no reason. And by the way, just in case you think I'm being crazy, we will get incestuous marriage too. People say I'm crazy. I had one student this summer get really mad at me because I suggested that. I'm like, look, I'm not the one who said it. It was the Australian Supreme Court judge who last year, before I went down there and visited, said, hey, listen, we already know that we can have marriage without babies. We know that we have the pill and abortion. So marriage doesn't have anything to do with children. Who are we to say that a brother and sister can't authentically love each other in that way? And you know what? He has a point. If that's the definition of marriage, who's to say? A month after he said it, an ethics panel that advises the European Supreme Court, or the European High Court from Germany, said the exact same thing. We're discriminating against incestuous couples. And remember, it has to do, it's not just a moral slide, it's a complete rethinking of what the sort of world we live in, the sort of relationships, the sort of creatures we are, the sort of people we are, and the sort of institutions we have. Does that make sense? Yeah. Now, let me just start right there. Stop right there and say something quickly, and then I'll wrap it up. Did I quote a Bible verse in any of that? No. Does the Bible teach this? You bet. All right. In the book, and I always choose whether I want to go with, does the Bible teach this or not? With young Christians now, I'm spending more time saying, what does the Bible say? And I'll tell you why. Because we have a whole bunch of evangelicals that are shifting on this issue and saying that, well, God didn't really say this. Jesus never talks about same-sex marriage. And by the way, he doesn't. And the reason is, no one talked about same-sex marriage until yesterday, right? I mean, it would make no sense. It would be like Jesus talking about astrophysics. I mean, no one knew back then, right? So my point is that you can get to the definition of marriage and the challenges of marriage, because marriage isn't just a religious institution. Marriage is a human institution. Does that make sense? I didn't quote a Bible verse, and that was intentional. In the book, what we do is we talk about the transition we've made, and then we say, what does God say about marriage? Should we do go straight to the Bible? And by the way, we never mention Leviticus once. There's a reason. Instead, we do what Jesus did. When Jesus was asked about marriage, did he go to Leviticus? When Jesus was asked about marriage from a Jewish legal scholar about a Jewish legal question, did he go to the Jewish law? Where did he go? He went back to creation. He said, don't you know what was true from the what? Beginning. So the place to start in a biblical argument is always God's created intent. Creation, fall, redemption. So what did God intend? How has that been broken? What does it look like to put that back together? That's a Christian vision of things, right? So in the book, we do spend actually two chapters, what does the Bible say about it? And then we spend two chapters, what if we leave God out? And what we do is we walk through this. Without ever referring to the scripture, you can talk to non-believers about marriage. Because here it is. The church did not invent marriage. And the state did not invent marriage. Marriage is the only institution we have that's pre-marriage, that's pre-church and pre-state. It really is. Does that make sense? And so we can recognize that through the scripture, through special revelation, and we can recognize it through natural revelation. I do want to point you, though, to one resource. It's an online resource that you may be interested in. If you teach students, if you want to have a conversation with a group of parents about this particular issue, specifically, how do we teach what the Bible says about marriage? I worked with some friends of mine to do a video on sex. Gender, Marriage, and the Bible is the title of it. Gender, Marriage, and the Bible. And you can go to Vimeo.com. Vimeo.com. V-I-M-E-O. If you search on Vimeo for me and Gender, Marriage, and the Bible, you can download this video. It's just like $3.99 or something like that to download it. And on that video, it's divided into four parts with questions and answers. So I teach for 8 minutes. I know it's hard for you to believe that I stopped after 8 minutes. I did. I teach for 8 minutes, and then we do a discussion. And I teach for 8 minutes, and then you can do a discussion. So it's a great thing to use in a small group setting on what the scripture, what Jesus specifically talked about when he talked about marriage. So that could be a resource for you. And then also in the same-sex marriage book, we do both what God says and what if we leave God out of it. Now what we're going to do in the next session here after we take our break. And by the way, I'll be happy to hang out here if you want to come up and ask questions or that sort of stuff. I'm going to try to leave some time for Q&A at the end. Is that good? As well. Because I've got to run and get that flight. But I want to give you time to interact. But what we're going to do in the next session is how do we approach our sexually broken culture, right? Listen, G.K. Chesterton said, there's a lot of ways to fall down. There's only one way to stand up straight. There's a lot of ways to fall down sexually, and our culture currently is. So same-sex marriage is not the only issue. The LGBT movement is not the only issue. We've got porn, we've got divorce, we've got especially cohabitation. Cohabitation is the one big thing in the room that we're not really talking a lot about. And so the question is, how do we think about and live in a sexually broken culture? So that's where we're going after the break. Does that make sense? All right, Dick, thanks.